Okay, we all set? Okay. Thanks, Mike, and good to be here. Once again, just mention an announcement that was made. Quiz rally on the 27th. If you go to Lakeside, you won't find it. It's going to be at Believers. So if you're going to the quiz rally, be sure you show up at Believers on the 27th. Obviously, a lot of competition that's going on then. But a lot of people spread out and go different directions, and that's great. We're looking for an exciting time at Believers in Augusta for the quiz rally then. And as Mike was saying, a great book, this book of Zechariah, as we're going into this and as we've been looking at different times at the minor prophets overall. And tremendous study in the minor prophets. And I have to say a bit as far as kind of a truth in advertising here this morning. And if you were looking for the least likely person, really, to be directing a study on Zechariah and some of the things in Zechariah, I would be your nominee. There are a lot of people who really, shall I say, have just kind of prophecy people who are just caught up into prophecy. They spend their time studying prophecy. This is what they love to do, and they love to go to all the little items that are there and the symbols and try to track down what that is and determine what all of that, what it means. I haven't. I don't. That's not something I particularly enjoy doing. I tend to look at prophecy. I took a couple of courses in prophecy, Old Testament prophecy, New Testament prophecy, when I was in college, and I've sat in on a few seminars and classes and things here and there, and I'm fairly satisfied. I've got an overall picture of where it is. I tend to look at the big picture. And we have the church, we've got Israel, we've got the nations that are out there. And they're going to be, if you want the big picture, the very simple part of all of this, there's Israel and what we're looking at in much of the minor prophets in Zechariah. And there are going to be a lot of wars and people are against Israel. God's on Israel's side. God's going to win. We're on the right side. And that's the way it is. So, okay, now we can move on. What would you like to talk about? that's the big picture of all of this. So that's been pretty much my approach in looking at a lot of prophecy, because I've listened to some people who have picked apart the little items and telling you exactly what this is, and sometimes it turns out not to be exactly what they picked out that it was going to be. So I think we have to be very, very careful with a lot of it. And I come back to a remark that I've made, I think, every time that I've talked about the minor prophets and any element of prophecy. And it's when you go to the New Testament and look at some of the interpretations of prophecy in the New Testament, where the Lord interpreted some Old Testament passages for us. And if you had been back then reading that Old Testament passage, there is no way that you would have ever interpreted it in the way that the Lord, and the only way we know what it means is because the Lord, with inspiration, provided that interpretation for us. So my simple point is, when we get to a lot of the little details here, you have to be very careful and just take it with a big grain of salt, and the Lord may have some surprises for us and what is coming up. I think, again, we can look at the larger picture. We can see that fairly clearly. But a lot of the little details are there that I don't know. If you ask me questions on this, probably the most frequent answer you're going to get today will be, I don't know. And so you can just save your questions. Maybe ask Mike. Maybe Mike knows or someone else here. But there's a lot of it. I don't have an answer for it. I've read, and some of the other people, they disagree on it. You've got good scholars, good people, and you look at that, and they just have to leave it there. I think it's where we'll get there a little bit later, but the passage, and he talks about the three shepherds, and I think it's Warren Wiersbe finally says, bottom line, three shepherds, we don't know who they are. Nobody knows who they are. And so there's not much point in trying to figure it out. So we'll get to that point later on. But I appreciated Wiersbe's honesty, at least in addressing that. The others will say, we're not sure who they are, but, and then they try to go on and tell you who they are. And, you know, that's where it is. So that's kind of my approach to to Zechariah. But I think there are lots of principles here and concepts for us to get, and I hope that I'll be able to give you, in a sense, if you haven't studied Zechariah, if you haven't been reading, except just reading through Zechariah, that you'll have a little bit better understanding of what it is all about, where it is going, some of the broad outlines and concepts, and what's here, and that you will go back and study it. And so we're just really going to open up the outer shell this morning, I think, of this book. It would take years and years, I think, to master it as it should be mastered. So invite me back in about 40 years. And if I study it continuously from this point to that, I'll be able to come back as an authority on Zechariah. That's just simply the levels that I think are there that you can keep boring down into and into and into to try to get the ideas and the concepts there. Now, if you look at your handout and go to the historical background for just a moment. We have gone over this before. This is from the last time. What I'm going to do, I'm not going to go over all that we had last time of the introduction. I'm simply going to hit highlights from the introductory material. And I've included the introductory material that we had last time. The handouts are in the handout that you have this time. So you have the complete package all in this handout. But I'm going to hit the highlights of the introduction that we did in the first couple of chapters. And then we actually stopped last time at the end of chapter 2. But I know there are people here who weren't here then and others who have forgotten whatever we talked about then. So we will review just a tad. And then we will move on, beginning with chapter 3. But look at the historical background of this on the little chart that is there. And, of course, we have the captivity of Judah coming from Nebuchadnezzar, 605 to 586 B.C. And then Cyrus the Persian king conquers Babylon in 539, and then a year later, 538, issues the decree for the return of the Jews and other captives to their homeland. And very interesting here, and you connect this with Haggai, that Cyrus specifically says that for them to go back, and he has been commissioned in a sense by God to release them, to send them back to the land, to build the temple. And that's there, the beginning of Ezra, that this is part of the purpose of Cyrus releasing them to go back and helping provide for them to go back to specifically build the temple unto the Lord. And then in 536, we have about 50,000 who return, go on one time or another, coming back to the land. And so here they have come back essentially to rebuild the temple. And initially the altar is rebuilt, the sacrifices are offered in the seventh month, and then in 535 B.C. we have the actual work on rebuilding the temple, which is started. And then there is opposition almost immediately from others in the land and who are opposing all of this. And again, all of that detail you'll find in Ezra. So there's opposition, and consequently they stop the building of the temple. And notice that it lies dormant here for 15 years. And this is when Haggai and Zechariah really come on the scene and start their ministry. And so Haggai is in charge by God to exhort the people to get back to what God called them to do. And with Haggai, while there are passages in there that look forward in a prophetic manner to the end times and the Lord's rule and His coming and all of that, a lot of it is very specific to getting to the work that God had called them to do, that they were not about the task. And so one of the things that I've emphasized in the last few times is prioritize, prioritize, prioritize. That was the emphasis of Haggai. Get your priorities right. The key phrase in Haggai, consider your ways. Give thought, reflect upon seriously what you're doing. You're setting the wrong priorities, and you're about building your own houses, taking care of your affairs, and the work of God over here is not being dealt with. And that, in essence, is really the book of Haggai, as the Lord commissions him to give them this message. There is a universal response by everyone, and they set to work rebuilding the temple. And so we find this in 520, and so this Darius finds the decree of Cyrus, approves the rebuilding, and all of this gets underway again. And by 515 B.C., we have the temple completed, the dedication, the Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread celebrated. So all of that within about 5 years is done. Now, in this time, notice you have Haggai and Zechariah. So both of them are ministering. They are contemporaries, and their ministry overlaps. Haggai really starts earlier, and his exhortation to rebuild the temple. And then about a couple of years before the end of Haggai's ministry, Zechariah begins with his prophecy. So we're about halfway through the process of rebuilding the temple when Zechariah gives his first message over here. So that gives a little bit of a timeline of what is going on and what's taking place back in the land. I think important a couple of things there is that the principle of working together in the harmony that we have Haggai and Zechariah both ministering at the same time. Haggai, apparently an older man, some think that perhaps he was carried away in the initial captivity having seen the first temple, and that he was in Babylon and that he returned, so quite elderly at the time. There's some discussion on that. We can't be sure, but that is at least a possibility. On the other hand, we know of Zechariah. Zechariah was a young man. And so we have both an older man here and a young man. We have the two of them working together with complementary ministries. And what Zechariah has to say is not the same thing that Haggai has to say. But they're both speaking to the children of Israel back in the land during that period, and they complement each other beautifully. And I think certainly a picture there of brethren working together for the Lord in harmony, not doing exactly the same thing, but complementary ministries that work with each other and accomplishing the purposes of God. I think also with Zechariah, the fact of here is a young man, and so to the young men who are here, I think it's Wiersbe makes particularly this point of emphasizing the youth here. And in doing that, you're simply saying, you know, you can do something as a young person. You don't have to wait until you're 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 or whatever to do something for God. And he uses the example of someone coming to him, starting out in the ministry and kind of being frustrated because they were young. And his response was, you have a book that's a couple of thousand years old, you know, so you've got some, here's some age. Rely upon the book, not upon just your knowledge and experience. So here's Zechariah as a young man doing some great things for God. So it is possible, and certainly there are contemporary examples of that taking place. And again, basic introduction into the book. It is one of the least frequently studied books in the Bible. Should I ask how many people have really spent time studying the book? I won't ask this morning. I don't want to know. Maybe all of you are scholars in the book of Zechariah, in which case I'm going to leave. So I'll just go ahead in ignorance here that I don't know whether you've studied it or not. One commentator refers to it as the most difficult book in the Old Testament. And some others have said perhaps with the book of Revelation, Zechariah is the most difficult book in the entire Scriptures. And what's kind of neat, you're reading along, and a person said, this is one of the most difficult books in the Bible. Then they say, now, this is the most difficult chapter in the most difficult book. And you say, oh, great, you know. So there you are. Well, come on down. Notice a couple of these. Calvin particularly talks about its relevance to our day, appropriate for when the church was under attack. And if you'll come on over pages, Zechariah's message touched the hearts and lives of this confused band, bringing them hope and encouragement. And that is one of the keys. And that's what you find with Haggai and with Zechariah. That at the core of their message is a message of hope. That here is a band of people back in the land. They are now, they're really not a kingdom as they were before. They are just a subset of the Persian Empire, and they don't have their own rulers. Zerubbabel here is just a governor, in a sense, under the power of Persia. There's nothing of the grandeur and the might that was there when the earlier temple was built under Solomon. And so here is this band back in the land. They're trying to rebuild the temple, and Haggai talks about it when they are rebuilding the temple, that those who saw this, they wept when they looked at it. Now, we're told in Ezra that some of them, when they first laid the foundation of it, they wept. Some were weeping for joy that it was being done, and others were weeping for sadness because it just wasn't going to be on the scale of what it had been before. And we find that again, twice it's mentioned for us in Haggai, that there's weeping and they were disconsolate as they looked at how pathetic everything was at that particular time. And so, consequently here is a group of people, it's the right group of people, it's the people who've left Babylon, it's the people that have given up what was there to come back, endure the hardships of crossing the desert, getting back into the land, and being there in a difficult place, and they've come back to rebuild the temple. So it's the right people that have a desire to do something for God. But there's discouragement that is just abounding as they are back in the land. And so what you have, I think, with Zechariah and with Haggai, both, they are saying, lift up your eyes. Look at the larger picture. Look at what God is doing. Here is a message of hope that even though the beginnings here are small, even though this doesn't compare to what had been done in the past and the grandeur of the kingdom and the grandeur of the temple, nevertheless, this is something that is starting here that God is going to use, and out of this one day it's going to be a glorious temple with glorious events that are attached to it. You are part of a larger picture. And to me, that is the most exciting message of Haggai and Zechariah. You know? And that's what warms my heart. Every time I get bogged down in some of the detail, I come back to that larger picture that God says, I'm at work, I'm doing something, and you're part of this little picture. You know? And I think, wow, today, right here, this is all part. This is not the totality. This is a little part of a much larger picture that God is at work, and there are believers here, believers there, believers in all these different places. And even though it may be a small group, even though it may be struggling, it's still part of the larger picture of what God is doing. And we have to remember, God saves people one person at a time. You know? There may be large meetings, but everybody gets saved one person at a time. And that's the way God does His work. And so little bits, little pieces here and there, and it all comes together in a larger plan. And to me, as I say, that's one of the most exciting parts of Zechariah and what we have here. I want to look at the statement that is here, Dan Schmidt's chapter on Zechariah. Put your hope in God. Notice what F.B. Meyer calls his commentary, the prophet of hope. We find that over and over again. Zechariah's heart is captivated by hope that lifts him above the immediate difficulties into the coming glory. There is a king on the horizon, and beside him, all else pales. The Lord will appear, the sovereign will march, God will save. Wow, that doesn't cause your heart to get excited that here is what God is doing. And then this rather lengthy quotation here from Merrill, but I think it's worth taking a look at as he pulls together some of the whole thought that's in Zechariah. The overall teaching of Zechariah, though occasionally obscure, is largely clear and plain. I'm not so sure about that. The prophet is concerned to comfort his discouraged and pessimistic compatriots who are in the process of rebuilding their people and restructuring their community, but who view their efforts as making little difference in the present and offering no hope for the future. And I love this last section. With his eye on both the temporal task at hand and the eschatological day to come, he challenges members of the restored remnant to go to work with a full understanding that what they do, feeble as it appears, will be crowned with success when Jehovah, true to His covenant word, will bring to pass the fulfillment of His ancient promises to the fathers. So, question that was in their minds as they came back from captivity. I mean, they have been under God's punishment, and as they come back, are the promises still in effect? Is God still going to bless us? Is there a future ahead for us? And that's what is being given here is a reassurance to these people that yes, you are still God's people. Yes, there is still a plan. Yes, there is still a future. Great things are in store. And while it is a book of encouragement, it is also a book of prophecy, ranking with Daniel and Revelation among the prophetic books. and more prophecies about the coming Messiah here in Zechariah than in any book other than Isaiah. Some of the ones that are mentioned: Christ's entry into Jerusalem, betrayal by Judas for 30 pieces of silver, being forsaken by his disciples, his death, his second coming. All of those are there. Identity of Zechariah, we really don't know very much about him, except he lived, he died, he was the son of Berechiah and Iddo, and referred to in Ezra as the son of Iddo. Probably Iddo was a grandfather. Iddo was a priest returning with Zerubbabel, and he may have simply been raised by his grandfather. That's a possibility. Which also gives us some insight here that Zechariah was a priest as well as a prophet. But he doesn't emphasize his priesthood. The focus all the way through is on him as a prophet rather than as a priest. And to me, this is marvelous here. His name means Jehovah remembers. I mean, that every time you saw Zechariah, it was Jehovah remembers. God has not forgotten us. And I think how important for us to remember that God doesn't forget. And the only thing he forgets is our sin. Isn't that wonderful? The only thing that God can forget is our sin. Everything else he remembers perfectly. When we put that into our own way of thinking, it becomes so much better because we realize we cannot will ourselves to forget. We do forget. I see students who forget all the time. And I forget all the time. You ever have this moment? I thought it was just the senior moment, but I found out from my secretary the other day, who's considerably younger than I, and she said, I can't believe it. I walk into the house, and I walk into the room to get something, and I stand there and think, what was it that I came in here to get? And I thought, wow, what a relief to find out it happens to, other people as well. So we have those moments that we simply forget. But we can't will ourselves to forget. And the things that we would like to forget still pop into our minds, and we're never sure. But God perfectly can will himself to forget. And he says, their sins and iniquities I will remember no more. Period. They are gone. Okay? But on the other hand, God remembers perfectly all that he wishes to remember. And so God remembers this, and he says of Israel, I love this over in Isaiah. Remember what he says of Israel? I have engraven thee upon the palms of my hands. Wow. Message that I heard at Bible conference that's been, oh my goodness, 40 years? Can it be that long, hon? 30 years ago? 40 years ago. How could that have happened when I'm only 35 years old? I don't know. Okay, I don't know. But it's one of those messages that you hear that you never forget. And the whole message, all of it was, I've engraven thee on the palms of my hands. And he simply talked about what that meant and the fact that it cannot be erased, it can't be removed, it was a permanent, it was there always before. When you turn your hand like this, it's always there before God, and how I've engraven thee. So he could not forget them. Jehovah remembers. In the organization, I'm not going to go through each one of these because we're going to look at that as a larger picture, but just the overall scope of this, just the broad categories. You have an introductory section which really goes in chapter 1 up through verse 6. Many include that as a subset of the first part, which has to do with the night visions. So you can either break it apart and take an introduction and then take the night visions, or you can include the introduction with those night visions. So you have an introduction that identifies him and a general call for repentance on the part of those there in Judah at this time in verses 2 through 6. And then you have the night visions, which begin with chapter 1 and verse 7 and goes all the way through chapter 6. And as I said, we're going to go through those night visions, so I'm not going to go through all of them here. What is significant here is that the night visions all occur in the same night. So it takes him 6 chapters to go through this and for us to read it, but it is a single night event of all of this taking place. And so one after the other, these visions come to Zechariah. So this is a substantial part of the book. So you've got this first part, introduction, night visions. Then you have really what I would call part two, and that is the messages concerning fasting And a group comes to Zechariah with questions here, saying, should we continue fasting regarding the temple and the fact that the temple had been destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar? And so they instituted a fasting and so forth. Now that the temple is being rebuilt, should we continue to do this? And we have two chapters, chapters 7 and 8, that deal specifically with that question. And then we come to the final major division, and this is what we would label as the prophecies here of him as opposed to the visions and the specific oracle or response to the question on fasting. And that begins with chapter 9. And so chapter 9 through chapter 14 is the other major division of the book. So if you want to look at it in three major divisions, the introduction, the night visions, the question on fastings, and then the prophecies. And 9 through 14 deal with the prophecies. But 9 through 14 also subdivides into two major areas. And so you have chapters 9, 10, and 11, where you are looking a good bit at the first advent of Christ in that, and then the second, in which definitely the emphasis is there on the second advent of Christ and the ultimate future kingdom, the millennial kingdom that will be set up. So that is an overall breakdown of what we have there. Now let's move on over to the actual exegesis of the various chapters and the visions that are here. And again, as I said, I'm just going to hit highlights of this portion that we looked at earlier. And the exhortation, notice it is just a couple of things. The time is about a month before Haggai received his final message. The foundation had been laid, but the work had not been completed. The authority of this, the Lord of hosts, used some 53 times in the book of Zechariah. And the Lord of hosts is the emphasis of God in his ultimate power, his authority as a commander of all of the hosts of heaven and earth. So this is what they needed to hear. All-powerful one who is in charge is the one who is speaking. And this is what we have throughout the book of Zechariah. And the exhortation here at the early part is simply a message to learn from history. And the reference is back to what had happened with their fathers. Their fathers had not listened. Their fathers had been taken off into captivity. So learn from history. And of course, as Andy, resident historian over here, can tell us, the only thing that we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. So unfortunately, that's been the story of civilization after civilization, as well as the story of the children of Israel. We come then to the various visions that are here. And this vision, again, we looked at this last time, vision one, the four horsemen. And you've got the man riding upon a red horse is the angel of the Lord, a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus Christ. The riders of the other horses are a band of angels traveling throughout the earth. And he asks an angel who is an interpreting angel who is there for him to interpret these particular events. Suggested that the myrtle trees, the idea of the downtrodden and defeated, that they will still emit a sweet fragrance to God. And this coming from the leaves of the myrtle trees. That's at least one possible suggestion there. The interpretation of all of this, that the band of angels report that the earth is at peace, and because of the power, again, this is supposition here, the power of Persia. They walked about the earth, and here is the Pax Persiatica, God who has brought the peace, not Persia, though Persia is the instrument that God has used. Israel is discouraged because they're still part of the conquest. The temple and the city are in ruins. And the Lord expresses his displeasure. He has used the nations to punish Israel, but it's an expression of his displeasure with those nations for the harshness of their punishment of the nation of Israel. So here is a message of, again, hope, comfort, and encouragement to a despairing people. The horns, the four horns, and the four craftsmen. And the horns represent political and military power, suggesting authority, prestige, influence. Going to particularly to Daniel, you have the idea there of horns. And the carpenters or artisans, craftsmen, They are seem to be destructive, and you can look in Isaiah and Ezekiel to get that. And just quickly, interpretation. The four horns are powerful nations that have dominated Judah. Some say they cannot be identified. Others would identify them as Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. And then the four craftsmen, the nations that have in turn brought down each one of those nations. So it is a nation rising up, captivating Judah, then another nation coming along who puts that nation down as Medo-Persian conquered Babylon and so on. Then ultimately you have Greece under Alexander the Great who conquers the Medo-Persia, then the Roman Empire rising. So all of this. The vision three, the man with the measuring line, and here particularly is focusing on Jerusalem, and it's on future events, though a timely contrast to Jerusalem with walls in disrepair at that time. And the emphasis here that God, it's not going to be in the physical walls himself, but God is going to be their wall. And the city is going to be of such enormity here in the population. Remember, we've got a handful of people there, basically. And God, he's saying to them, the Jerusalem is going to be so expansive, it's going to spread out that it won't be able to contain them within the walls, and God will be the protecting shield round about Jerusalem. And that, of course, is what we find filled out for us, fleshed out for us in these later prophecies that we have in chapters 9 through 14 of God as the protector of Jerusalem and doing battle for Judea, land of Judea. And the north one here particularly is Babylon, but I think he has a much larger dispersion in mind. It is not just what had taken place with that. And one of the things that I think is nice in this, or beautiful, that he reaffirms his love for his people, and referring to them as the apple of his eye, the pupil, the tender part of the eye. And just the concluding note on that, that he is going to be with them as his people, the theology of the presence of God with his people, beginning with God walking in the garden, then in the midst of the camp, Christ coming among his people, and finally reigning in the midst. Note, he is king over all the nations, over all people, but he is going to reign from the temple in Jerusalem, and overall here we have a renewed emphasis on the temple. So it is God in the midst of his people. He is in the midst there in the garden. He is in the midst in the camp. Later on, he is going to be in the midst in the temple, and it's not going to be just of Jerusalem, but it's going to be of the whole earth as we come to the millennial kingdom. So God in the midst, and the nation of Israel as his people. All right. As I said, I was not taking time with that. So they went through that pretty quickly. Yeah, I did, because we already been through that. So, all right. And that was just what we have already covered in much more detail at an earlier time. So I don't want to belabor that for those of you who have been there. Now, we are going to read this as we go through, because it's awfully hard to talk about it if you just make reference to it. So I think it's worthwhile. So as we go, we're going to read the chapter so that we can put it in perspective rather than just talking about it and trying to go back and read it later. So let's begin with Zechariah chapter 3. And he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. The Lord said unto Satan, The Lord rebuke thee, O Satan, even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the angel. And he answered and spake unto those that stood before him, saying, Take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, Behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with a change of raiment. Wow. Isn't that tremendous? Oh, so good. All right, keep going. Five. And I said, Let them set a fair miter upon his head. So they set a fair miter upon his head, clothed him with garments, and the angel of the Lord stood by. And the angel of the Lord protested unto Joshua, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, If thou wilt walk in my ways, and if thou wilt keep my charge, then thou shalt also judge my house, and shalt also keep my courts, and I will give thee places to walk among these that stand by. Hear now, O Joshua the high priest, thou and thy fellows that sit before thee, for they are men wondered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant the branch. For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the graving thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of that land in one day. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, shall ye call every man his neighbor under the vine and under the fig tree. Now, Joshua, we know from earlier portions, and particularly from Haggai and from Ezra, Joshua was the priest, the high priest at that time, with the remnant that had returned into the land. So you have Haggai and Zechariah the prophets, you have Zerubbabel the governor, and you have Joshua the priest. So that really makes up the structure of the group, the remnant that has come back. And we look at the elements here of the vision. You've got Joshua, but notice he is clothed in filthy garments, standing before the angel of the Lord. And the angel of the Lord, very clearly, as we have in other passages in the Old Testament, a pre-incarnate appearance of Christ here on the scene. Now, so that you've got him speaking as God, but also speaking for God. So it's an interesting blend that we have there, that certainly the angel of the Lord is God. But yet he also speaks over here for the saith the Lord of hosts. He is quoting what the Lord of hosts says. So it's kind of an interesting relationship between the angel of the Lord and between Jehovah, who is here. Satan, let me just say the filthy garments that are there, and that's we have in verse 3. They are indeed filthy. And the Hebrew in this suggests just filth. That's the only way to put it. So they are, it's not just walking in dirt, but it is filthy, filthy garments that no one would want to have on that he stands there. Okay? And notice Satan is there as the accuser. And again, this certainly brings to mind the book of Job, and where Satan has access before God to accuse Job, and Satan comes from walking to and fro on the earth and making accusations. So how ready Satan is to accuse. And I'm very thankful here, once again, it is the Lord that rebukes Satan. And the Lord has the answer to Satan's attack here and his accusation. Notice the Lord rebukes Satan and identifies Joshua as a brand plucked out, as a brand plucked out of the fire. And with this brand plucked out of the fire, how what a beautiful image that is. And I think probably is one coming out of the fire of the persecution, of the captivity in Babylon, of the judgment of God that had been upon them. And now here is one plucked out of all of that. Notice God says he has taken away his iniquity and now clothes him with clean garments. The clean garments here, and this is we're going to see very interesting a little bit later on, because the blend is just so beautiful. Because he puts on him clean garments, and we think, all right, here's the priest, and so he's going to put on clean priestly garments. But he doesn't. He puts on him royal garments. And the word that is used there in the Hebrew, as I understand it, I do not read Hebrew, so I have to take this on other people what they say. But they say that the garments here, the meaning of this carries the idea of royal garments, the ones that would be worn by a royal family. And those then are placed upon the priest. And it's very interesting because later on we're going to see another dimension of that. Here he gets the garments. Later on there's going to be something else that's given to the priest that pictures for us that beautiful blend of priest and king, only fulfilled ultimately in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ, but certainly being pictured for us at this early stage with Zechariah. Just a little imagery that is there. Notice he is giving a promise to Joshua conditioned upon his obedience. He makes the promise of bringing forth his servant a branch, of providing an engraved stone with seven eyes, and we'll say something about all of this in a moment, removing the iniquity of the land in one day, and peace under the vine and the fig tree. So those literally are four things that he describes are going to happen. And is somebody else going to give me a time signal or something, or do I just, he's going to give me the, okay, good, thank you. Good, just want to check here, all right. I run on bells at school, so just, okay. So there are no bells ringing, no telling what's likely to happen here. Let's look at the interpretation of this, and we'll pick up there on some of this as a branch and so on. But notice, Joshua, the high priest, represents more than just himself as the high priest. It is the nation of Israel. He is standing as the representative of the entire nation, taken out of the fire of judgment in Babylon. He had been cloaked in the filthy garments, and that made him and them, the nation of Israel, unfit for service. In that kind of filth, etc., you could not serve. I'll go back earlier Old Testament, the requirements for the purity of the priests, the garments, the washing, all of that was to take place. And of course, here he is unfit for any kind of service to God. And this was the condition of the children of Israel when God sent them into judgment. Remember, God had said, if you obey my word, if you do what I tell you to do, if you listen to me, then, you know, I'm going to bless you. And they didn't. And they turned away, and God says, all right, I've got to bring judgment on you. And he sends them off into captivity into Babylon. It's God's judgment upon them because they were not serving him. And now they are unfit for service. But God says, I'm calling back a remnant here that's coming back. And that I have called them back. I am cleansing them. And ultimately that cleansing, an ultimate sense of that that's going to take place when their iniquity is taken away in one day. When, as Zechariah tells us, they're going to look upon him whom they have pierced. So we're having the inkling of that right here, of taking away that iniquity and making fit for service, but it's ultimately going to be in that day, is what he is talking about, and Zechariah is going to take us to that point as well, when they behold him, the one that they pierced, and there is a wholesale repentance on the part of Israel. Now they are restored to the land, they are cleansed and clothed, and he says here is they are back in a manner for service, and God's instruction to them is to serve me in the right way, to keep his commandments and his law. I want to look at the branch and the seven eyes here, and the stone with the seven eyes. And notice here in verse 8, and he says, I will bring forth my servant the branch. Once again, beautiful combination of messianic prophecy. Thank you. Messianic prophecy here, both of those, my servant the branch. And both of those are terms that are used in the Old Testament referring to Christ. My servant, we have that in Isaiah specifically, Isaiah 42. Now, important to recognize that it's not only use of Christ. My servant in the Old Testament refers sometimes to people. It refers to my servant David. He refers to other individuals as my servant. He refers to the nation of Israel as my servant. But very clearly, there are those passages where the reference is to my servant, very specifically messianic in nature. And in Isaiah 42:1, behold my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delighteth. I have put my spirit upon him, and he shall bring forth judgment to the Gentiles. And then, of course, the most well-known passage of all of that in reference to Christ as the servant, in Isaiah 52 and verse 13, behold, my servant shall deal prudently, he shall be exalted and extolled, and be very high. So both of those passages in Isaiah identify this messianic reference here, my servant. But then note the branch. And again, clearly used Old Testament reference as a indicator of Jesus Christ. Messianic references as the branch. And we'll get a number of verses on this. Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1. There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, and a branch shall grow out of his roots. Here is a stem, something coming out, a direct line. And so the emphasis there that there is going to be one growing out of the direct line, going back to David, going back to Jesse, and one in that royal line who is going to rule. And we have at least four dimensions, and as our brother was talking about earlier, I didn't bring it up here, but David Barron, and I certainly will endorse everything that he said about David Barron's commentary. You'll have a marvelous time reading that. It will take you a while, but it's worth the while. And in there, particularly, he points out the four different dimensions of Christ as the branch, and then correlates that with the Gospels. And so we have Christ as the branch of the Lord in Isaiah 4:2. In that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. The branch of the Lord, corresponding to the Gospel of John, where the Lord Jesus Christ comes as the Son of God, the branch of Jehovah. The ideal king, Jeremiah 23:5. Behold, the days come, saith the Lord, that I will raise unto David a righteous branch, and a king shall reign and prosper, and shall execute judgment and justice in the earth. So here is the ideal king, the branch, corresponding, of course, with the Gospel of Matthew, who sets forth the kingship of Jesus Christ. And then Zechariah 3:8, the passage we're in now, and what is it there? It is, my servant, the branch. And my servant, the branch, corresponds very easily with Mark and the Gospel of Mark, the Gospel of the servant. And then finally, in Zechariah 6, where we're going to come to this again, and speak unto him, saying, thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, behold the man whose name is the branch. So it is, behold the man whose name is the branch, and that corresponding with the Gospel of Luke as the Lord Jesus Christ as the Son of Man. So four dimensions that we have, Old Testament, speaking of the branch, characteristics of the branch, and then those certainly represented by the four Gospels in the New Testament and the way they picture Christ to us. So again, I just suggest that. That's worthy of much more study, pursuing it. And as I say, David Barron takes that and he goes, and after a while, one of the things I always say, now to return to the section of our text over here, after he has gone off on pursuing some of these marvelous, marvelous other trails. So it's great. One other thing I will tell you about him, though, is that he thinks he's right. And which is good, you know, you ought to think that. And he will go through and he will talk about all these other, some of these different people and different interpretations, and then he will come to the bottom line and say, of course those are all wrong, and here is the right interpretation of that. But it's good. He's got some pretty good arguments and some good interpretations with that. Yeah, and the fig tree here, let me just come and say a word about that, and then I think we'll stop because we're right at the end, and we have the next next vision to go to, and so I think we'll stop before we even start on that one. But under the each person sitting under the vine and under the fig tree, that represents the period of God's rule upon the earth, of people sitting in peace and harmony with one another. And so this will be a time of prosperity and peace when they can sit under the vine and under the fig tree. It's used in other places to represent that. Oh, the stone. Yeah, I almost skipped over the stone here. Christ is the branch, but also as the stone. And probably, again, the cornerstone is what is in mind. And in a graving, an engraving upon the cornerstone. And we're not sure just what that engraving would be. Once again, speculations, people have put that. The scripture doesn't tell us, so I don't know what that is. But the cornerstone, here is certainly Christ pictured as the cornerstone of the temple, and the temple, the larger temple that the Lord is building now, the one that is not of stone, but the one that is of the church, the people, and the Lord is the cornerstone, the foundation that is set forth for us over in 1 Peter. So there's the picture of Christ there, and of course he is the cornerstone represented here of the temple, as well as the one who is going to occupy the temple in the millennial kings, in the millennial kingdom. The seven eyes, once again, a lot of different views on that. I think overall the best that I've seen suggests that it shows God's omniscience, and the reference to the eyes that's used later on in Zechariah, and suggests God seeing all that is there, omniscience, dominion, control of God. The seven eyes that are suggested here for the stone upon which all of this rests. Okay, well that gets us through chapter 3. We only have, 11 more to go. So, right. Okay, I think we'll go ahead and take a break here. Am I right on target? Good. Thank you. Okay.